Believe in yourself, cause it starts with you, and then everyone else will believe you too. And if it looks like you're the only believer around, just keep on believing, don't put yourself down, just believe.
Our guest tonight grew up in Napa, California, and became a football coach. He led UCLA to a Rose Bowl victory in 1975, and was a head coach in the NFL for 15 seasons. He led the St. Louis Rams to victory in Super Bowl 34, and owns the distinction of being named Coach of the Year on four levels: high school, junior college, NCAA Division I, and the NFL. Famous for hugging and tearing up, his name, Dick Vermeil. And I'm Jack Grasula, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. I'm Jack Grasula. This is Anything Is Possible, and we're talking to Coach Dick Vermeil, who in 1999 led the St. Louis Rams to their first ever Super Bowl in Super Bowl 34. Coach, welcome. A real honor to have you.
Yeah, nice to be with you.
Can we start by talking about your childhood and your mom and your dad?
Well, I was born and raised in the Napa Valley, 1936, 75 years ago, north end of the Napa Valley. My dad ran an old garage there in Calistoga. Had one full-time employee, my brother-in-law. My mom was a housewife, and, just a very, very strong family. The garage was 25 yards behind the house, so you were always in the presence of your mother and father. So it was a great way to grow up in that there really weren't any rules. Kids could be kids, and they weren't being reprimanded for every little thing they were doing. And you could get on a bicycle and ride to the mountains at the north end of the valley in 5 minutes and be up the hill with your .22 or shotgun and stay up there all day and come back down when the sun was going down, and your mom would ask you, did you have a good day? It was a great, great way to grow up.
Coach, what's the biggest thing you learned from mom, and what's the biggest thing you learned from your dad?
Well, I think my dad, hard work. If you ever want to be anything in your life, you're going to have to work hard. And I think the other thing would be integrity, extremely honest. My mother had great compassion for other people. She was very empathetic, always giving to others, helping others in need.
Whenever you left your mom and dad's house, your dad would say to you, quote, remember, you're a Vermeil. What did that mean?
Well, he didn't have any rules. He didn't have rules. Well, I don't want you drinking beer. I don't want you driving too fast. All he said was, remember, you're a Vermeil, because my dad took great pride in his family name, his heritage. He was a French-Italian. Both grandfathers had come to San Francisco, one from Italy and one from France, and he was very proud of that heritage, and he passed that on to us, and he wanted us to be very proud of our heritage and our family name and always represent it in a class manner.
He would have loved for you to work with him in the shop. How was it you got into coaching?
Well, when I was a high school senior in a class of 29 kids in my senior class in Calistoga, 130 kids in school, a young football coach came to Calistoga on his first head coaching job. His name was Wilbur Wood, Bill Wood. And he inspired me. He recognized that I wasn't doing anything in school, and he said I was a better student than the effort I was putting into it, and I was a good enough athlete to play college football if I wanted to. So I started thinking about that, and then just being around him and following him, and that it sort of inspired me. He inspired me to be a high school football coach, and my goal was to end up being his assistant coach somewhere down the road. And I got out of college and got my master's degree and became an assistant football coach in high school. And then I was going to go be his assistant. And I was given an opportunity to be a head coach, so I never got to work with him, but I remained close to him all the rest of his life.
We're talking to Coach Dick Vermeil, and he owns the distinction of being named Coach of the Year on four levels: high school, junior college, NCAA Division I, and the NFL. Coach, what's the differences between coaching high school, college, and the pros?
Well, the most obvious is the size and speed of the player. Okay. For me, I never really approached it much different. in that, you know, I always believed that you coach people that play football. You don't coach football. And I never changed that. I was more knowledgeable, more deeply involved in the game because you had more time and more responsibilities and more pressure and all these kind of things. But really the number one thing different is the size and speed of the player, and then the amount of time that you have to coach them, and then the amount of information they're able to absorb and learn and then execute game day because of their maturity.
What do all the great coaches have in common?
I think all great coaches are good leaders, good teachers.
You've been around some great ones. Can we talk about Lombardi?
Well, I met him. I coached against him, but I didn't know him personally. And he's certainly one of the great coaches of all time. You know, as soon as you win a Super Bowl, you become more recognizable. And, you know, he did it a few times. Other great coaches like Sid Gilman and Bill Walsh and these people are in the same category. You know, Sid Gilman is not as recognized because he didn't win a Super Bowl, but he probably passed on more to the game than any coach that ever coached it.
You mentioned Bill Walsh. What can you tell us about Walsh?
Creative thinker, great human being, very, 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 very close friend. I think of him all the time. I have a picture of him here with me. At three different levels of our careers together. We'd worked together at Stanford. Then we were good friends when we were head coaches and remained good friends when we were out of coaching. So I think of his brilliance, his ability to recognize new things to add to the game, his willingness to do it, never afraid to be the first guy to do something first. He was very special.
Don Shula.
I think of a great leader and the overall command of the game. You know, like Bill Walsh, he could be the president, general manager, and head coach as one package, you know, and there weren't many of those kind of guys.
In 1969, a man hires you, George Allen, with the L.A. Rams, to be the first ever special teams coach in football. Tell us about that experience.
Well, George Allen hired me to do that because he had a good friend at Stanford University who was the track coach, Olympic track coach as well, Peyton Jordan, and they were friends. And he called Peyton and asked Peyton Jordan if he knew of a young coach in college that might make a good special teams coach. And Peyton Jordan recommended me. I had been working at Stanford for 4 or 5 years at that time. And so I interviewed for the job, and he hired me. So I spent a year as the first special teams and coach coaching football, and it was a lot of fun. But I missed not coaching offensive football as well, and that's when I left to work for Tommy Prothro at UCLA as his offensive coordinator in 1970.
We're talking to Coach Dick Vermeil, and I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything Is Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Dick Vermeil, who became the head coach at UCLA in 1974. Coach, 1975, you lead UCLA to a Rose Bowl win over Ohio State, who at the time were undefeated and ranked number one. Tell us about that experience.
Well, it was a great experience, one of the great experiences in my coaching career, because they had beaten us, I think, 42-20 in the regular season. And therefore, they came to Southern California very cocky, almost assuming that they had already won the game before they played it. And it's hard for a coach, regardless if you're Woody Hayes or Vince Lombardi or anybody, to convince your team somebody can beat you after you have beaten them 42-10. And, you're number one team in the country, and you're playing in the biggest bowl game of all bowl games at that time. And I don't think they really listened to Woody Hayes. And fortunately for me, my guys were listening to me, because by the end of the year, I felt we were an outstanding football team, that we certainly could beat them if we could play play our best game on the same day. And that was our goal in the 15 days of preparation. Everybody play their best game on the same day. And for the most part, that happened.
You've got it all with UCLA. And then you get a call from the Philadelphia Eagles. And from 73 to 75, they were 16-25-1. They did not have a draft choice until the fourth round in 76. They didn't have a draft choice till the fifth round in 77. They wouldn't get a first or second till 1979. You leave UCLA and you go take the head coaching job with the Eagles. Why?
Well, you know, you get very few opportunities in life. And if you pass one up, you never know if you're going to get the next one. And I was happy at UCLA, but having been an assistant in pro football, I knew what it was like. And I just really didn't believe that somebody would call me up on the phone and say, I'm flying out here to talk to you about being my head coach. And so I talked to him. I turned it down at first. Leonard Toews we're talking about, Philadelphia Eagles. And then he sort of convinced me. I talked to George Allen. And George Allen says, Dick, you take that job. You know, for a real good job, it would already be taken. Someone would be there and winning. So you might as well go there and turn it into a good job. So I did. And fortunately, I listened to George Allen, and we had some success there. I made some mistakes, but overall, it was a great experience.
You turn them around in 1980, 12-4, and you get to the Super Bowl. What was that experience like?
It was a great experience to go to the Super Bowl. You know, it was almost beyond my ability to handle at that time. I was very intense, emotional, workaholic, driven to the point that it was almost a negative when it came to getting ready to play that game, because then I tried to lump, maybe more work in getting ready to play it than the players could handle. I don't know. We didn't play as well in the ball game as we were capable of playing, and we got beat. We turned the ball over three times. But whenever you lose a game, the magnitude of a Super Bowl, somebody can come up with a reason. But basically, we just didn't play well enough that day, and the Raiders did, and they were world champions, and we were runner-ups. At first, it bothered me really bad. But later, as I matured, I realized that, it takes the same thing to go to a Super Bowl and lose that does to go there and win. Fortunately, I had the opportunity later on to go there and make that come true.
Let's go to 1982. After the 1982 season, you leave coaching. You leave the Eagles. Why?
Well, I allowed a passion to become an obsession. I just couldn't not turn it off. I didn't feel good doing anything other than working, and I felt guilty if I wasn't working, and I started blaming myself for everything went wrong, and it's slightly compulsive behavior on my part, and it was a spiral downward, believe me. And I knew the only way I could prevent myself from going in a hole so deep that I might not be able to recover from was to walk away from the game for a year. So I did that. And CBS then called me and asked me if I'd like to be a broadcaster. I went in and auditioned with Pat Summerall, and I did a good job, and they hired me. And I went from making $75,000 a year working 52 weeks a year to $150,000 a year working 16 weeks a year. So I said, wow, this is stealing for a living. And I enjoyed it. It was fun, and it allowed me to regroup emotionally and physically and everything else. And I kept thinking about going back in, and I had opportunities to go back, but I was still not secure within myself that I wouldn't find myself in the same hole I was in when I left. So I just stayed in broadcasting.
14 years later, 1997, you go and you become the head coach of the St. Louis Rams. Why?
Well, I figured at that age, by that time I was going on 60 years old, no one else was going to call me up and offer me a job. The Los Angeles Rams had offered me the head coaching position each time it had been open. Now it's the St. Louis Rams, and they're offering me the position. And I figured, first off, they are sincere because they did offer it to me every time. And I had worked for the Rams ownership as a young assistant for Chuck Knox and Tommy Prothro there when Carol Rosenbloom took over the team in Los Angeles. So they knew me. Georgia Frontier had confidence in me. And I think she felt she knew me, so she felt secure. So John Shaw, the president of the team, offered me the job, and I took it. And it was, it took me a while to get going again. I hired a very experienced staff, surrounded myself with some real good people, and we really went to work. We went to work like we did in Philadelphia, the old-fashioned way of preparing a football team. with pads on every day and long practices and double days and everything else, all and long practices and pads all through the seasons for 2 years. And then we backed off and did a more typical modern NFL approach to coaching our third year because I felt we had sort of arrived to the point where we wanted to be, and the players really responded. And with the help of my coaching staff, we ended up being world champions.
Let's go back to January 30th, 2000, Super Bowl 34. You're playing Tennessee Titans. Talk about that experience.
Well, you know, I don't know if I've ever gone into a game I was so confident we were going to win. I knew we were a better team, or at least I felt strongly that we were a better team, and that if we didn't lose the game, we would win it. And I wanted our players to go in the game reading me being very, very confident. I wanted them to eliminate any doubt that they couldn't win the game. I wanted them to go in there not afraid of losing, but thinking about winning, and just turn it loose and have some fun. And they did that. They did that. The game ended up being closer probably than it should have been because we didn't take advantage of some opportunities in the first half that we had, but that's credit to Tennessee. So, you know, it was an unbelievable experience. The experience, when it's all said and done, is probably you can't anticipate how you're going to feel when you win it. You really can't. And it may not reach the magnitude that you anticipate it reaching before you reach it, but right away I felt humble. I felt appreciative. I felt wonderful about being able to share that experience with so many people. You know, you're talking about a Ram organization made up of players, coaches, personnel people, management people, ownership, and then the city of St. Louis, and indirectly Los Angeles fans that hadn't lost their loyalty to the Rams. So, and it, vicariously, I was hoping too that the Eagle players that went to the Super Bowl with me that lost the game were also sharing in the experience. So it was a very humbling experience. But I know that I couldn't anticipate how I was going to feel prior to it happening. All of a sudden, it hits you, and you know that you are a world champion, and then you respond accordingly.
Arguably the most exciting of all finishes, 6 seconds left. Man named Dyson gets tackled at the 1 yard line, and you win 23-16.
Yeah, well, Mike Jones made the tackle. I'm going to speak at his football clinic in Jeff City in St. Louis next month. So we've maintained good contact over the years. And yeah, big play. And I'm standing in a position on the field where I couldn't tell if we scored or not. At the 50-yard line, you're looking down that way. You can't see. So I waited to see what the officials on each goal line there standing there did as they walked in. They didn't put their arms up. So then I said, well, hey, we must have won it.
What did you tell your squad after that game?
Well, as I think back, I talked about, you know, making sure you know that you guys did this together and that you've built a relationship through hard work and commitment to each other and being unselfish and giving everything you had to give and loving each other, that it's a bond that should last a lifetime, you know, and to enjoy it.
We're talking to Coach Dick Vermeil, who's famous for hugs and tears. When we come back, we'll ask him about that. And I'm Jack Rasul, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. This is Anything Is Possible. I'm your host, Jack Rasula, and we're with Coach Vermeil, who's famous for hugs and tears. Coach, how many hugs and tears that night?
Well, gosh, I don't know. You know, I don't know how many, but a lot. You know, I appreciate relationships. I take them very, very serious. I've always been a very emotional guy. I don't know why, but I am. And I used to embarrass myself and getting emotional and getting tears in my eyes or choking up talking to somebody that I really care about. But it is sincere. And later on in my life, I quit worrying about it. You know, hey, that's just me. And I learned to live with it and accept it. It's maybe not a weakness, but as a strength. And you know, it just I have a very, very easy time becoming very close to somebody and taking the respect to another level, therefore creating an emotional bond that really touches me.
If there's a dad listening tonight who finds it very hard to be soft, what would you say to him?
Well, first off, I think as a parent, the number one responsibility you have is to help them develop a level of confidence that they can succeed in whatever they strive to do. You know, and I think you can't do that by beating them down all the time. I think you've got to remain on the positive side. You don't want to contaminate your reward system, but at the same time, you want to be positive as many times as you can, or always find something good in what somebody's doing, especially your own child. And I think I did a better job of doing that with players sometimes than I did my own family. But anyway, I've always believed that. You know, you can't make a champion out of somebody you continually call a chump. So I always worked on the positive side. And John Wooden told me a long time ago, don't worry about your opponent. Just worry about making each individual you have on your squad the best they could possibly be. And then you collectively put them together, and you're going to end up with very, very good teams.
The quarterback for that Rams team, Kurt Warner, a special story. Tell us about Kurt Warner.
Well, Kurt is special. You know, he's special as a person, you know, but what he needed was an opportunity to really display how special he is, you know, and he went way beyond my expectation. When we worked him out, I liked him. We signed him as a free agent coming out of the Arena League. We sent him to the Europe League to play 10 games. He did a good job there. He was our third quarterback in 1998 and the most valuable player on the scout team, playing the role of the visiting quarterback each week against our defense. But in watching him, you could see that he threw the ball accurately. But he'd never been tested. The next year, I made him my backup quarterback, and Trent Green got hurt in the third preseason game and was out for the year, so he became our starter. And from there, he wrote his own story. Tremendous natural poise under pressure. And never would have that opportunity presented itself, at least that year probably, unless Trent Green gets injured. And I think it's like a lot of, these Navy SEALs, you never know how good they are until you give them the opportunity to go prove how good they are under pressure. And he had the ability to slow the game down. When he played game day, it didn't get faster. It slowed down for him. And he was totally aware of where everybody else was and what they were doing. And consequently, started out playing like he'd had 6-7 years of experience playing in the National Football League. Tremendous poise under pressure.
You left the Rams after 99. You took a few more years off, and then you go with the Kansas City Chiefs in 2001. Talk about that experience.
Well, first, it was a mistake to leave the Rams. I should have stayed there. I was exhausted physically and emotionally at the end of that year, and I felt winning a world championship it would give me an opportunity to end my career as a world champion. And I have a NFL Coach of the Year trophy on it, and it has a lot of the names on it, including mine. And, you know, most of them had been fired after they won it. And I said, you know, well, I have a chance to be NFL Coach of the Year, win a world championship, and remain that the rest of my life. And my kids wanted me home, so I made an emotional decision to go on home. When I handed out the Super Bowl rings to the squad in May at the Super Bowl party, I realized I had made a mistake. And then Carl Peterson, the president of the Kansas City Chiefs, who had worked for me at UCLA and the Eagles, offered me the job to come and coach the Chiefs, so I went. And I'm sure glad I did, because it was a great experience. The only regret is I didn't get to take them to a Super Bowl or help them get there, because Lamar Hunt deserved a Super Bowl as much or more than anybody I ever worked for, a wonderful human being. So it was a great experience. We made the playoffs my third year there. We won 13 games. At one time, we were the only undefeated team in the league, having won 9 straight. We were rolling, and we just didn't get it done. Peyton Manning came to town and beat us in the playoff game. Therefore, we didn't win. It's still, to this day, the only playoff game ever played in the history of the NFL that were neither team punted. It was an offensive display. But they came out with more points, and we went home. And 2 years later, I retired, it was time. I still had the passion, but I still had the energy, but I didn't have the stamina because I felt during the toward the end of the year my mind wasn't working as good because I was tired all the time, and you live in a constant state of being tired in the National Football League, and I just felt somebody younger and more alert, especially toward the end of the season, should be doing it. So I went home.
Do you ever miss it, Coach?
Oh, sure, I miss it. What I really miss is the relationships first, the relationships with the organization, the ownership, the relationship with your coaching staff and your players. There's a bonding that exists, at least in the way that I coach, that nothing can replace it other than your own immediate family. Of course, when you get home, your own immediate family, they got their own lives to leave. They got a lot of things going on. But anyway, yes, I do miss it.
Could you tell us a story about one or two special players, not the greatest players, but the one that inspired you the most?
Well, God, I've been around so many players that inspired me. I think the first player that really, really inspired me was Wilbert Montgomery, who came to Philadelphia as a sixth or seventh round pick my second year here in 1997, and went on to be a great player, one of the fine players in the National Football League, one of the second or third best running back every year in the league. Not so much always in the yards, but in the way he played the game. And he just really inspired me. He was humble. He was a giver. He was an extremely hard worker. And to this day, he's still the same guy. He's coaching the running backs at the Ravens. I think he was the first player in the NFL that really inspired me. In college, it was John Shira, my All-American quarterback who led us to a win in the Rose Bowl. He inspired me. Just the total, complete person he was. I think at the Rams, there were a number of guys that inspired me. And sometimes they weren't always the obvious guy, you know. But, of course, Kurt Warner did inspire me. Trent Green inspired me in that he came there. It took him 8 years to become a starter. He's going to be a starter. And he goes down with a knee-ending injury. And his attitude and how he handled that and everything was inspiring. And I had so many people. DeMarco Farr, our defensive tackle there, inspired me with his work ethic and his passion and his intensity. And he was a college free agent. London Fletcher, that he was a college free agent, 5'9", 240-pound linebacker, to this day is still playing and has made more tackles in the National Football League than any other player that's played since he became a starter. So all these guys inspired me. In Kansas City, it was Priest Holmes and Trent Green. People that, you know, John Browning, John Browning, a defensive lineman that was just a great human being, sort of a silent storm type of guy that, that touched me. Touched me as a person, touched me as a player. You know, I've got so many of them, I could go on and on and on.
Another thing that inspires you today is wine. And you have the Vermeil Winery, vermeilwines.com. Talk to us about your passion for wines.
Well, my passion for wine developed through my family in the Napa Valley. My grandfather made all the Vermeil family wine as a kid growing up. One of my assignments at crush time was to help my grandfather, especially as he got older, and my brother Stan would do the same. You know, and not real physical, but hard work, but it just, you know, it inspired me then to help make it a little bit. And then, you know, a couple of years later, you're drinking what you helped make or tasting it as a kid. And, like, we used to get a shot glass full of wine at the dinner table, you know, all those things. And then my dad was a wine guy. And, you know, and the reason we were in the Napa Valley was my great-grandfather had a wine business in the Napa Valley on the Italian side of my family. So, you know, it's always been an interest. And I maintained that interest all the way through into the 90s. And then in 90, I asked a good friend at On the Edge Winery, Paul Smith, if he would make me some Jean-Louis Vermeil Cabernet. Jean-Louis Vermeil was my great-grandfather's name on the French side and my dad's name. And I said, I'd like to honor that name and what they believed in. And will you make me about 150 cases of wine? You can sell it. You can keep all the money. And, you know, we'll do it. So we started bottling it. Our first vintage was 1999. And we kept doing that same thing, and he sold that as one of his On the Edge Winery products. And then I got out of coaching, and some friends came to me, including the winemaker Paul Smith at On the Edge Winery, and said, let's turn your Vermeil name and label into a full-fledged wine whiskey. So we did. We're now making 5,000 cases of wine. We've won some awards each year that we've been bottling our new vintages. And we've won double gold medals with a couple of our different red labels. And so it's going well, you know, and I'm having fun with it. It requires some time. It requires some the same things to be successful there that doesn't coaching a football team. You got to have some good people with you that are willing to work and make the commitment to do the right things right for the right reasons and the right way. And so far it's going well, and I'm enjoying it. And, you know, I enjoy the overall atmosphere of being in the Napa Valley during the harvest, driving the tractor, going to Wyoming, going through the crush, and you know, all the different things that, you know, you don't have to be an expert to make a contribution, and our winemaker is the expert, and I'm the physical labor guy.
If you want to learn more, www.vermeilwines.com. And I'm Jack Crystal, and this is Anything Is Possible on News Talk 760 WJR. Welcome back to Anything's Possible. I'm Jack Rasula, and we're with Coach Dick Vermeil, who led the Rams to their first ever Super Bowl in Super Bowl 34. Coach, you're famous for a lot of things, one of which is the Vermeil Seven Common Sense Principles of Leadership. Can you talk about those, please?
Well, I developed these when I matured as a football coach. Different concepts and principles that I sort of learned and then zeroed in on and utilized as me, the leader, the coach, in working with communicating and pushing people to their fullest. And when I got out of coaching, then I started writing them all down, not in book form, but in a way that I could deliver them intelligently to somebody that wanted to listen to me speak on that topic. So, you know, it all started, you know, as you learn from your players, you know, and then you take what you learn from players and what you believe in and you move on. And my number one concept was just always make sure that people know you care. It's amazing how people will work if they know you really care and you're not selfish, you're not working them real hard because for your own personal reward and ego, you're working them hard so they can be the best they can be, whether it's a high school player, a junior college player, a college, or an NFL player. You just, you know, and if they know you care. In fact, we use the common sense principle, which I've read somewhere along the way, that people don't care how much you know until they know how much you care. And I really believe that is true. The second principle is be a good example yourself. You know, your people cannot be what you are not. And I've seen some people try, but it really didn't work very good. And if they see in you everything you want to see in them, you've got a chance. But I don't think you can be a phony and be a good leader, especially in the high-performance business, you know, and of creating great teams against very good, capable leaders. The third concept, which is always create an atmosphere in which people enjoy working. Let them come to work, even though they know they're going to work hard, that they're going to enjoy being there, enjoy being with their teammates, enjoy being with their coaches, enjoy being with their management. This is especially true in the National Football League, that they look forward to getting into the building, going to work. They look forward to getting on the practice field, and they know it's going to be tough. I'm not talking about being soft atmosphere, but an atmosphere which they know they can excel, an atmosphere that they know they're being treated like a human being should be treated with great respect and admiration, but pushed at the same time. The other thing I think we always felt we had to do is we had to define why we're there. We had a lot of know people, why are we working like we're working? What are we here for? We're here for more than just to make a living. We want to make a difference. And so I always said the first thing I had to do is define everything for everybody, everybody's responsibility, so they could hold themselves accountable, let alone me holding them accountable. Then I had to delegate and make sure that I allowed other people to feel that they were making a contribution. Then I better step up and be the leader. And I think the next thing was to make sure you bring energy to work. You're never energy neutral as a good leader. You're either supplying energy to people or inspiring energy, or you are sapping it from them. I did a combination of it all. But there is no easy way. Very few people get better by working less, and I've always believed that. And so, as I said earlier, that's what I learned from my dad. You work hard, you work hard, you work hard. The other thing which I enjoyed most is building the relationships as you go through the process of implementing your vision of what you're there for, your value system of what you believe in, and your process of how you go ahead and get everything done. And this is what I miss the most, the relationship part. And to this day, there isn't a week that goes by that I don't talk to four or five of my former players, all the way back to the high school days, college days, and now more NFL days. And then, last but not least, be sincere. Make sure you tell the truth. Don't con them in any way. You know, and there's an old expression that I read a long time ago that's so true. If you have integrity, nothing else matters. If you don't have integrity, nothing else matters. Tell the truth. Be honest. Be sincere. And I built that into a package for an hour presentation to large organizations. I did two last week, and I enjoy doing them. It gives me a team to coach for an hour and to be in a leadership position, and I enjoy it very much. But these concepts that work for me, are they unique? I don't think so. Should everybody be doing it? No. I think that you have to be yourself. You have to do what you sincerely believe in, or else you can't get it done. But those common sense principles are what I believe in.
We're talking to Coach Dick Vermeil. Coach, recently you were inducted into the California Sports Hall of Fame.
Right.
And you said the whole essence of my acceptance speech was, quote unquote, I am a because of guy.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean by that?
Well, I meant because of all the good players I've had the opportunity to coach, and because of all the good assistant coaches that have worked with me, I end up as the leader being the guy that's recognized and put in different Hall of Fames. I'm in the Missouri Hall of Fame. I'm in the Pennsylvania Hall of Fame. I'm in the California Hall of Fame, and I've been nominated for the NFL Hall of Fame because of the contributions of all the people I've surrounded myself with.
As our time winds down tonight, what advice would you give to our young listeners, Coach Vermeil?
Find something you love doing and then do it very well. Find a passion. Follow that passion. Be as honest as you can possibly be, and work hard, and you're going to enjoy a great life.
Coach Vermeil, you've been inspiring America for decades. You're still doing it. Please keep up the great work, and thanks a million for being a guest. Please join us next Sunday. Until then, I'm Jack Rasula. Thanks for listening. And make it a great week, because with God, anything is possible. Spohom.